Incredible story about the life of Marilyn Monroe, huh? The murder of Marilyn Monroe. Richard Buskin with us and Jay Margolis. Talk about Princess Diana, the Princess of Wales, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Richard Buskin with us, Jay Margolis, and Richard and Jay, before we move on to the Princess Diana story, then both of you, no doubt, are convinced that Marilyn Monroe was indeed murdered. Richard?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, all the evidence points towards it. It definitely doesn't look like a suicide. People that we spoke to, I understand that people can be suicidal and not let on, you know, their mind could just turn in a minute. But everyone that we spoke to said how upbeat she was that last week of her life. I spoke with her stand-in, Evelyn Moriarty, who was on her last three pictures. And she said that she spoke with Marilyn a couple of nights before she died, and she just couldn't wait to get back to work. She was calling all the cast and crew. So it really doesn't point towards that. And as I said, the accidental overdose theory is really knocked out in our book. So I'm quite convinced that it was a murder.
Also, it's very important to realize that the autopsy surgeon, Dr. Thomas Noguchi himself, has already ruled out accidental death as not possible in this situation. Her stomach was empty. There were, you know, she was purported to take 64 sleeping pills, 47 Nebutals and 17 chlorohydrates, yet not one undissolved capsule was found in her stomach. That means right there that she was murdered. And in addition to that, Marilyn didn't have enough drugs on hand to match the high levels of drugs later found in her blood. Her physician, Dr. Hyman Engelberg, had prescribed 25 Nebutals on July 25th, and then Marilyn refilled that prescription for 25 more Nebutals on August 3rd, one day before her death. That's a total of 50 Nebutals. The coroner of Los Angeles County, Dr. Theodore Curfee, would have us believe that Marilyn swallowed 47 of those 50 Nebutals and a large amount of chlorohydrate. Marilyn's best friend and masseur, Ralph Roberts, said Marilyn took about 6 Nebutals per day. So it's difficult to believe Marilyn would wait a week and hoard 47 of those 50 Nebutals just to kill herself.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, the case closed, the books are done, most of the people are dead. Will America ever get, you know, other than your books and your research, will America ever get the public word on what happened to her?
Well, see, the thing is that what it all comes down to is that people want to believe what they want to believe, regardless of logic or, you know, actual common sense.
Yeah.
You know, there's still three camps that people strongly believe accident, even though it's not medically possible. They strongly believe suicide, even though it's not medically possible. And what I mean by that is that it's not medically possible in her situation with an empty stomach. Medical professionals say there should have been undissolved capsules had she swallowed 64 pills. It just does not go right through the system.
I mean, we get a lot of stick from Marilyn fans as well, who, you know, don't want to believe she had an affair with either Kennedy. I mean, they just want it to be purer than the driven.
Yeah, smoke, yeah, that's it's obvious she did.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
All right, let's move on to Princess Diana's story. Of course, she dies in August of 1997. Mm-hmm. And very strange circumstances. The driver is accused of being drunk.
Yeah.
Just a weird story.
He
and
was
then
not
we
drunk. He was totally not drunk.
He was drugged, wasn't he?
No. See, what happened was that his blood report was mysteriously switched with someone else who committed suicide that same day, who had lethal levels of both alcohol and carbon monoxide in his blood. In fact, Henri Paul, the driver, can be seen on surveillance footage 5 minutes before the crash, where he does not look like he has beyond the lethal amount of alcohol in his body. He is standing upright and appears very sober. He ties his shoes. And it's just a really strange case because the authorities have us led to believe that he got the carbon monoxide from the airbags exploding or something, but he died on impact, so it couldn't have gone there after his death. That doesn't make any sense.
All right, so let's go back a little bit on her situation. She, of course, is the Princess of Wales, and she's married to Charles. They get divorced in 1996, right?
Uh-huh, yeah.
And then she starts dating Dodi Fayed.
Right.
What's happening with the royal family here? Are they going crazy about this?
Oh, they don't like it at all. In fact, you know, there's a lot of motive for them to want to be involved in this. In fact, it's been alleged by several Diana biographers.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, you know, I'm not one of these people who sort of sees a conspiracy theory in every situation. Life happens.
Right.
On the other hand, you don't want to be naive. And, you know, initially, I was sort of thinking, really, we know the history of the royal family through the ages. There's lots of murder and treachery. But this current generation, I wouldn't have thought, you know, they would stoop to that. But I have to say, there's a lot of evidence that strongly suggests this was no accident. I mean, you know, for example, why was Diana not taken to a closer hospital when this was the most logical thing to do? I know that the French authorities said they often, you know, try and save someone at the scene, but it took almost 2 hours to get her to any hospital. And there were so many of them just minutes away.
Is it true that the ambulance she was in was seen basically parked on the side of a road or freeway for at least an hour with her in it before it went to the hospital?
That's correct. There were doctors who responded on the scene. They saw that Diana was actually, you know, conscious. She was talking, but she had internal bleeding, and she was not pinned in her vehicle. And that was the reason why they said they kept her so long there, was because she was pinned in the vehicle and that they needed the jaws of life or whatever to get her out of there. But that wasn't true. And, I mean, an hour and 40 minutes to get her to a hospital, it's like 5 minutes away. Are you serious? That doesn't make
any sense. She bled to death. You know, she would have survived had she immediately been taken to the hospital.
Her lungs filled up with blood. She probably suffocated in addition to her injuries, of course.
Yes, her lungs collapsed.
And how many people were in that car? Were there four people in the car?
Yes. There were...
The only person who survived was the bodyguard who was sitting in the front passenger seat, and he was the only one who was wearing a seatbelt.
Okay. Well,
here's the thing, is that Princess Diana's, you know, she's always, you know, remembered for wearing a seatbelt, but the thing is that mysteriously, her seatbelt is defective that night, so she couldn't have worn it, even if she wanted to. She normally would have put it on.
Another coincidence, Jay?
It seems too coincidental. It's just ridiculous.
And for three people to die in a Mercedes, and, you know, that was an S280. That's a pretty solid car.
Exactly. And Henri Paul was very trained in how to, you know, get diverted from, you know, situations like this. If there was something that went wrong, he was a very good driver. It wasn't like he was, like, a terrible driver. He was a very good driver, above average.
Now, the paparazzi, they were following the Mercedes, right?
That is what they said, but that's not true. That is not true at all. They were like at least like a minute or more away. That was not the case at all.
So they were there, but a ways back.
Yes, and see, the thing that really made the Mercedes crash was that there were witnesses who mentioned that there was like this motorcycle with two motorcyclists on it, and one of them got off and put a strobe light right in front of Henri Paul's line of vision, and then right after that, boom, right into the 13th pillar.
And here's something else. Mysteriously, the authorities claim that the tunnel cameras weren't working that day. That can't be true because another driver later received a speeding ticket, which was caught on camera in that very same tunnel only minutes before Diana's own car crash.
So what you're saying, Richard, is somewhere, someplace, somebody has the video of this accident, or this whatever it may be.
Exactly. So this was no accident. This was a pre-planned attack, and Diana was not expected to survive. In fact, she actually predicted that this would happen. She wrote in her own words, she said, quote, "My husband is planning an accident in my car, brake failure and serious head injury," end quote.
When did she do that?
This was shortly before her death, and it's notated by her best friend.
Was she warned? How would she know that?
She was actually very suspicious of her phone being tapped, so there's like a lot of parallels to Marilyn here.
Absolutely.
You know, and so that's kind of eerie.
Now, why kill Princess Di? I mean, why get her out of the way?
Well, we've got a similar situation to Marilyn. I mean, she has already gone public, of course, as we know. You know, she did in book form and covertly at the time, and also in TV interview. However, She was seen by the royal family certainly as a loose cannon, and they didn't know, you know, what she was going to be coming up with next. There was no controlling her. She was basically separated from that family now, and I don't think they'd ever had to deal with a situation like this in modern history, where they've got someone who's really just not towing the line and playing their game. And it's, you know, they couldn't get her to shut up.
Was she pregnant with Dodi Fayed's baby?
Most likely.
Yeah.
And you know, they embalmed her right away, which is illegal against, according to French law. You're not supposed to do that until, you know, like an autopsy was performed, but they just did it right away so that nobody would ever know for sure.
I mean, was she that damaging to the royals to do her in?
They
well,
didn't like
to
her.
Do her in, I, as I said, I had trouble with that, but she definitely was causing major problems for the royals. And even in death, look what happened. You know, the Queen had to make, you know, a statement, you know, to the world, basically on TV, about how they were in mourning for Diana and, you know, it was going to be state mourning. I mean, they had to do a 180 really quickly because it was a PR exercise. She had that power over the public, and, you know, they had to do something to wrest the power back.
Who do you think knew about this death? This assassination.
MI6, definitely.
You agree, Richard?
Yeah, that's right. It's the British Secret Service, and
they're like the CIA, you know.
And again, for there to be a cover up, you know, if we're going to go with that theory that she was murdered, and it's all covered up, you could have people in high places that are going to enable that, because otherwise, MI6 are going to be doing the opposite, aren't they? They're going to be investigating. The very fact that, you know, everything is smoothed over strongly suggests that they're, you know, involved.
You wrote a biography, Richard, of Princess Di, as you have on Marilyn Monroe, of course, and we'll talk a little bit about Whitney Houston in a moment as well. Did you come across anything that just was shocking for you? I would say maybe this letter that she wrote about her own demise, but anything else?
Just really the treatment by the royal family of her. You know, she was suffering from bulimia, and the Queen Mother, who, you know, you sort of think of this dear little old lady who was, you know, smiling and waving. You know, she was one tough woman, and she apparently had absolutely no empathy for her at all. At one point, Diana threw herself down a staircase in front of her, and the Queen Mother just, you know, kind of walked away from this. It was just really the treatment by the family, as well as by, you know, Charles and his father, Philip, was, you know, pretty incredible, because Diana, growing up as a child, had grown up on one of the Queen's estates. She mixed in those circles. So she thought she knew what she was getting into with that family, but she really didn't. And I think in terms of taking them on, she was biting off more than she could really chew.
Why didn't they just let her go away?
Because I don't think she would go away. That's the point. She was such a publicity magnet. Everything she did, you know, the world listened and
sure.
followed.
And did she enjoy that?
That's the point. You know, she wouldn't go away quietly. And I think she was determined not to go away quietly.
I had heard the old myth that, of course, because she was opposed to landmines, and that was part of her thing, that manufacturers of landmines wanted her dead. Is that true?
Yes, it's definitely a, you know, part of the MI6 cover-up.
Is there that much money in landmines?
Well, yes, there definitely is. You know, I mean, the people Jeez. Who are into all that, you know, they don't want to lose money. And here she is, like a really powerful force, trying to say, no, I don't want landmines. And so, you know, public was going to listen to her, and nobody showed up at that conference after she died, you know, because she was not there to show up because she was dead.
I know Dodi Fayed's father was obsessed with trying to find out what happened, spent a lot of money. Was he ever satisfied?
About a year later, he stopped, and he said he was satisfied that, you know, that he knew that she was definitely killed. This was not an accident. He never.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't satisfied in terms of what, you know, the official verdict is. But he himself is absolutely convinced that, you know, his son and prospective daughter-in-law were murdered.
And his dad's still alive, 86 years old, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Egyptian?
Yes. Yep, and owned Harrods, doesn't anymore, but he did own Harrods, of course, at the time. And actually, for a long time after their deaths, he had a sort of memorial in the window of Harrods there in London, you know, to draw attention to them, and I think to kind of publicize what he was alleging.
And the father, where does he live now? Do you know?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I don't know if I think he's still in the UK. I'm not sure.
Did he ever spend time here in the United States?
Not really. Not a great amount of time. I mean, he was based in Britain for many years, and he actually also owned one of the soccer clubs there, Fulham, which is a London soccer club. So he has, a lot of vested interests in the UK.
If you were to poll Brits, if you were to simply ask them if they thought Princess Diana was murdered in this car accident, what would they say generally?
Oh, yeah, there's a poll done, and I think like a third believe that she was definitely murdered.
Is that growing from what it was?
Definitely, yeah.
It is, and that's a pretty large percentage, actually, because people, you know, general public, I think, tend to be skeptical about these sort of, you know, conspiracy theories. And to get a third of them actually believing it was possible, that's a pretty high proportion.
Yeah, there's no question about that. And so in terms of follow-up investigations, is it over, all done?
It'll never be over. I mean, everyone always, including the thing with Marilyn, I'm sure that eventually somebody's got to get this case, you know, reopened. But what was strange about the Marilyn case was that in 1982, the district attorney's office reinvestigated it. And then in 1985, they're ready to hold a grand jury. And then for the first time in history, a grand jury foreman is fired, you know, because he wants to say, yes, we're going to reopen this. And then the subsequent foreman just closed the case down and looked, it's never been open again.
And the same with JFK, you know, they reopened and investigated and actually concluded there was a second gunman. I think the Marilyn thing it keeps bubbling under. And, you know, we're hoping actually with the book it may provoke enough debate to get the case reopened.
I also want to mention one thing. Our book is the first book to name the third gunman who delivered the fatal shot to Robert Kennedy's head. He's never, you know, been mentioned in any book on Robert Kennedy's assassination before. See, the security guard behind Robert Kennedy shot him twice to the right armpit, then the third shooter delivered the fatal shot to Kennedy's head, and that's why the security guard said he got powder burns in his eyes. It was from the gun of the third shooter, not from Sirhan.
I'm not even sure Sirhan did it.
That's right. None of the bullets from Sirhan's gun, and he had eight, you know, shots in his gun, hit Kennedy.
That was a strange case. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that, Jay, when we come back. And, of course, the book, The Murder of Marilyn Monroe, it's out now. I know it's on Amazon. Is it in the bookstores, too, for people who still do that?
Definitely. You know, you go to Barnes & Noble, it's there.
Are there still bookstores?
Of course.
Still a few.
I mean, the Internet is doing everything. It really is. Well, good. And, Richard, for you, what's your next work? What are you working on now?
I'm working on a few different projects. I'm working with a fashion model in the Far East. I'm working with an Asian businessman on a book about achieving success in however you define success in your life. It doesn't have to be business related. It's a fascinating book, and that will be coming out hopefully next year.
All right, good. And Mohammed Fayyad, he moved to Switzerland, so he's out there.
Oh, there you go.
And we'll come back. I want to talk a little bit about Whitney Houston with both of you, and then you've just fascinated me about the RFK murder and assassination, so we'll talk about that. Final hour, we'll open up the phone lines. I know lots of you are calling now. Save your time. We'll do that in the last hour. Hey, we'll take your phone calls next hour with our two special guests as we talk about the murder of Marilyn Monroe, Princess Di as well. We'll talk a little bit about Whitney Houston as well. And I do want to get into this JFK assassination. That, too, is fascinating. Jay and Richard, I do want to spend some time on the Robert Kennedy assassination and that specific story. But Richard, you've also done some work about Whitney Houston. Is there anything unusual here about her tragic death?
Well, yeah, there are a few mysterious things. I mean, one thing I'll state up front is I knew someone who worked on her very first album back in the mid-'80s, and he told me long before the public knew this about her having a cocaine habit, long before she was with Bobby Brown.
Yeah.
So this woman had, you know, a habitual, you know, drug problem. However, you know, there are some mysterious circumstances surrounding her death. I'm not saying this makes it conclusive that it was murder, but it, here are the things that stand out. You know, first of all, she was found in a scorching hot bathtub. A little bit suspicious as to why she would be in that scorching hot water.
Right. I mean, almost too hot for the human body to step into, right?
Right, right. And then we've got, I think there's a former police officer who's claimed that he gave the FBI some surveillance footage of two men entering Whitney's hotel suite shortly before her assistant found her. And that officer asserts that the two men were there to collect a $1.5 million drug-related debt. And when she couldn't basically cough up the money, they were responsible for the bruise marks that were found all over her body, including her face and other what were called defensive wounds. So if she was murdered, it would, I suppose that would explain why she would ended, you know, she was mostly thrown into that scorching hot bathtub.
A drug deal gone bad, perhaps?
Yeah, or you know, a drug debt that, you know, wasn't honored.
Where's this video now?
It's with the FBI.
Yeah.
Why don't they release stuff like this?
I mean, you know, it's not in their best interest to, you know, go against the official verdict, which the autopsy surgeon said it was an accidental drowning, which is, you know, I don't believe that's what happened.
And they figure just let it go.
Exactly. I mean, why make a big stink about it?
Sad
story. They're not into exposing things like this.
I had seen her and Bobby Brown a couple years before she died, and they were at a hotel lounge, and she looked wasted. He looked okay. He came up to my table, and I'm going, oh, maybe he listens to my show. He didn't even know who I was. And but I mean, but he, you know, he was acting fine. He looked okay, but she really did look wasted, you know.
Yeah, her voice was wasted as well. You know, there was footage that was on YouTube before she died of some of the concerts she was doing. I think there was one in Australia, and it was pretty shocking because I saw her perform at her peak in the late 80s and the beginning of the 90s, and that voice was absolutely phenomenal. If anything, it was better than the records. You know, it was an amazing instrument, and it was completely fried, you know, a few years before she died. It was really sharp. And as I say, this whole thing that Bobby Brown, you know, corrupted her and turned this princess into a drug addict is really not true. She had the problem long before he came along.
And what a tragedy happening to her daughter now, huh?
Amazing, isn't it, how history repeats itself?
It really is.
You do get that. I mean, it's like Elvis Presley, you mentioned earlier. He died at 42, bloated, hooked on drugs. His mother died at 42, bloated, and hooked on drugs.
Yeah, it's almost like some of them do have death wishes.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It's really amazing.
Robert F. Kennedy, he's in California. He wins a primary. He's happy. He's jumping for joy. He's making his way through the back entrance. Something tragically happens. Jay, you say that there were several gunmen there. Go ahead,
there
elaborate.
There were a total of three gunmen. We have a 19-page postscript in the back of our Maryland book on page 169 in which, you know, see, literature up until our book came along only mentioned two gunmen, you know, the security guard behind Kennedy. He said that he drew his gun, but he didn't fire. I interviewed an eyewitness named Don Schulman. He's a KNXT TV employee. He was 19 at the time of the shooting, and he told me, quote, he said, one was Sirhan Sirhan, and the other one was the security guard. All of a sudden, Sirhan was a man who jumped out and yelled obscenities at Kennedy and shot at him, while the guard next to Kennedy pulled his gun and fired. I went out, and the first person I saw was reporter Jeff Brent, who interviewed me for Continental Radio about 10 to 12 minutes after the shooting. I was interviewed by a lot of people. I saw what I saw. The security guard shot Kennedy. He disappeared for quite some time, end quote. Now, that is the second shooter. He only shot him twice to the right armpit. But then there was a third shooter who actually shot him in the back of the head. And there was a confidential witness who was interviewed by Professor Mallinson. He's now deceased. But this witness mentioned, she said that the gunman shot no more than once or twice before running out of the pantry. And she said, quote, "And as I recall, one of them, the shots, was high and should have gone into the ceiling. I don't know what these people found when they did their ballistic test, but it appeared to me there should have been a gunshot in the ceiling." And so we mentioned two eyewitnesses that saw the third shooter in this book. Since the book was published, I have found a third eyewitness who I will not mention because, you know, it's not published information.
Understood.
I had this witness put under professional forensic hypnotism, and this person has picked out of a six-person photo lineup the person that we believe is the third shooter.
Huh.
So it's most
great
definitely,
work.
You know, we definitely named the right guy.
Oh, now let's talk a little bit about Sirhan Sirhan. A lot of people believe that, you know, he wasn't even a shooter, that he was, of course, obviously there. But, you know, his attorney believes that he is innocent.
Okay.
And I had talked to a guy years ago who worked in New York, and, you know, he was a proponent of Middle Eastern rights, and he was always trying to get Sirhan Sirhan paroled. That person has since died. But Sirhan, he basically has said, "I don't recall anything," yet he was there. He was tackled, right? And did they not grab a gun from his hand? So what's the situation there,
okay,
Jay?
A lot of people say that he was firing blanks, but that's impossible because then there wouldn't be enough bullets to go around. You know, the first there was an audio recording that captured 13 shots, at least 13 shots, and Sirhan had 8. So there have to be 5 other shots that need to be explained.
I mean, do you believe Sirhan was a shooter?
Yes, and he definitely did hurt the other victims, just not Kennedy. You see, there were 5 other victims
okay.
that got hit, you know, 1 bullet each. 2 were grazed on the forehead. Paul Schrade, who was Bobby Kennedy's friend, he was the first one to get shot. And it couldn't have been from the second or third shooter because, you know, Paul Schrade was behind Kennedy, and the second and third shooters were behind Kennedy closer than Paul Schrade was. So Sirhan, you know, fired 2 shots, and if you listen to the audio recording, you'll notice that there's 2 shots, and that's when Carl Uecker, the hotel maitre d', grabbed, you know, Sirhan's gun arm and veered it away from Kennedy. And then there was a flurry of shots, and that's when the second and third shooters started shooting.
Yeah, you could hear them say, "Get the gun, get the gun."
Yes. And so Paul Schrade was hit by Sirhan's gun, not by the second or third shooter. So, you know, when people say that Sirhan was firing blanks, that's incorrect.
What was the connection between these 3 individuals whom you claim were the shooters?
Okay, the third shooter is a Ku Klux Klansman. His girlfriend is the polka dot dress girl, who is a lot of talk about. Everyone knows who the polka dot dress girl if you read about the literature on the Robert Kennedy assassination. We actually name her for the first time. And the reason we're able to name her is because I did a first-time interview with Youth for Kennedy chairman in Panorama City called Irene Gizzi. She was 28 at the time of the shooting, and she saw a 5-person group, including the person we believe is the third shooter, and his girlfriend, the polka dot dress girl, along with 3 CIA agents, George Joannides, David Sanchez Morales, and James Hardesty Critchfield, who is a blonde man with horn-rimmed glasses. And they were in a 5-person group downstairs in the ambassador room, seen by Irene Gizzi shortly before the shooting upstairs in the pantry.
Huh.
And they were waiting for him there because the original plan was for Robert Kennedy to come down into the ambassador room to give the speech. But then, you know, this group of individuals had to reassess their plan because he went upstairs in the pantry. And Miss Gizzi said that the third shooter could have definitely gone right up those stairs up to the pantry, because that staircase led right to the pantry, and they were standing right in the shadows over there by that staircase, which led right up to the pantry. So it was very easy for the third shooter to change plans quickly.
And the polka-dotted dress girl, who apparently ran around saying, "We got him, we got him."
She said, "We shot him, we shot him, we killed him." Sandra Serrano, who was a Youth for Kennedy co-chairman in Pasadena, Altadena, she said, "Who did you shoot?" And she said, "We killed Senator Kennedy." That's what the polka dot dress girl said. And her name is Catherine Ainsworth.
Now, was Sirhan with her, too?
She was actually seen with Sandra Serrano said that she saw Sirhan, the third, you know, the guy who we say is the third shooter, and the polka dot dress girl in a three-person group, you know, near the fire escape before all this happened. You know, and then when after the shooting, she saw two of those people, not Sirhan, but she saw the person who's the third shooter and the polka dot dress girl running down the staircase saying, "We shot him, we shot him."
All right, what's the motive to take out Bobby Kennedy by these individuals or
okay,
groups?
Here's the motive for the CIA men is that, you know, the Bay of Pigs and Never Forgot, you know, they trained these men on the ground, and then when Kennedy didn't provide air support, you know, they got slaughtered. So, you know, they had a personal connection with these men that they trained. So the CIA didn't like that. And now for the motive for, you know, the third shooter, the Ku Klux Klan terrorist, was that he's against racial integration. And, you know, Bobby Kennedy is all about that. And so, and the security guard himself also stated on camera that he was against racial integration. So the second and third shooter have a remarkably similar motive.
What about-
I mean, there's also been allegations of mob, you know, involvement in all this, because as Attorney General, he really fried, you know, the mob, and the mob had helped get, you know, JFK elected
right.
in the first place.
Well, I was going to say, what about Jimmy Hoffa, who hated Bobby Kennedy and then died himself 7 years later? I knew the guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's
absolutely.
That's always
it's all,
a pleasant
it's all kind of interconnected, isn't it? It's anyone who can talk disappears.
Well, you know what? And I'm looking at these numbers. Marilyn Monroe dies in 62, John Kennedy 63, Robert Kennedy 68, Martin Luther King that year. I mean, what a tumultuous time in this country, but lots of weird things were going on here, Richard and Jay. I mean, lots of weird things. All our leaders, elected or not, gunned down, murdered. I mean, it seems like things were out of control in the 60s, doesn't it?
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, there's someone I can't name, but this person was sort of connected with the Chicago mob boss, Sam Giancana. And this person told me that in 1960, when Richard Nixon lost, you know, in a really narrow election to Jack Kennedy,
mm-hmm.
initially there was talk of there being a recount, and then that talk just kind of disappeared. And that the reason was, this person was in the room when Giancana said to Nixon, "Leave it alone, your time will come." And so you've got basically the Chicago mob boss acting as kingmaker in this country.
Hmm.
Just phenomenal.
You know, now, other than world events, things seem pretty calm here these days, don't they, compared to them?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of the attention, you know, that's what any government does, isn't it, really? If they can get the spotlight off of what's going on at home and get it, you know, people looking overseas. And that's what the whole terrorism thing has done, basically. It's taken everyone's eyes and sort of focused them overseas.
Yeah, there's something very strange going on this ISIS situation. I mean, it's very weird how they can get guns and ammunition. I heard tonight that they may be the reason why they're killing all these people tragically and horrifically is to get their body parts so they can sell them, you know, people who need kidneys and livers and organs and hearts. That's why they're killing these people. And,
I mean, it seems that, you know, there's a lot of gangsterism going on,
yeah.
Right? You know, I'm sure there's political extremism in there, but it seems now with ransom money being demanded and things like that, it's really just playing into the hands of just out-and-out gangsters.
Well, and let me ask you this. Have you seen any of the videos of the tragedies of the beheadings?
Oh, no.
Have you noticed, it. Well, if you haven't seen this, how about you, Richard? Have you seen it? Any of
yeah,
them?
I have.
Have
yeah,
you
I think
noticed
so.
At how calm the victims are?
Yeah.
I mean, I got to tell you, if ISIS was marching me on a beach, whether they had knives or not, or guns or not, I would know what the end result was going to be. Do you think I'd be that calm? I mean, I would go in a brutal fight because that's the way they're going to have to do me in. I'm not going to just walk along and parade. Every one of those people who got beheaded, they were all docile and calm. Did you notice that?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I was wondering if, you know, they're being drugged. They didn't look drugged. They didn't look like they were, you know,
out of it. No,
keel over. No, they didn't. But who knows? I mean, it is strange that they are. Every one of them, there's no one sort of crying or pleading for mercy.
Or just fighting. I mean, yeah. you don't have to sit back and say, hey, this is manly to just conform and get your head cut off. I mean, you know what? I wouldn't be marching down that beach. I'd be running away from that beach or, you know, fighting with the guy who is holding on to me.
Right. Right. And you see, that's the thing, isn't it? You know, they talk about terrorism, and if it reaches these shores, it has reached every shore, hasn't it? Because we are terrorized. And really, the media has stoked this like mad. And then it's like, well, who's behind the media stoking this? Is it, you know, our own government?
They say a lot of them are in the city of Mosul. Mm-hmm. I got to tell you, what I would do is I'd invite them all to come out to the desert. I would detonate a nuke so they could see the horrific end result. And then I would say, now this stops or the next one's on you. And, you know, as sad as it is, as tragic as it is, and, you know, I'm not proponents of using nukes at all, but I, you know what? I bet this would stop if you start taking them out that way.
Well, I suppose it depends on whether they're survivors or they're just completely nuts, right? You know, are they prepared to just go down, or are they people who in the final analysis want to survive?
I don't think most of them are suicidal. I think they want to hang, you know, a lot of them were unemployed. They're making some money now. This is their job. I really don't think they're suicidal. I think with reason something would happen. But, I mean, we need to get to the people who are supplying them with the weaponry. We need to get to the people who are buying the oil from them. And to me, that's what's strange. I think there's something bigger going on here where some government or organizations or black ops programs are supplying these people, because I've never seen an organization pop up so quickly with so many things. They've all got assault weapons. They've all got brand new vehicles. They've got, you know, launchers. They've got tanks. There's something weird here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and how many times have we, you know, this country been involved in fighting people who have been actually armed by us in the first place?
Yes, absolutely. And it just festered, and it just... It just grew. So, you know, in your book, The Murder of Marilyn Monroe, you know, it's much bigger, as you both know, than just the murder of this one actress. It has to do with, I think, government, actions of elected officials, everything. I mean, it's got it all.
Yeah. I mean, they treated her like a piece of meat at the end, you know, they really did. And it's scary, the power of the Kennedys.
Yeah, but she seemed to go along with it, Richard.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, well, when you say, no, when I was saying like a piece of meat, I'm not talking about the affairs. I'm talking about on that final night.
Oh, yeah.
The way they manhandled her.
Dropped her and everything else.
Absolutely. There's a photo in our book where she's, the stage photo where she's lying face down on the bed, and there's a huge bruise in the center of her back.
We're going to take phone calls with you both. Our final hour next on Coast to Coast AM.